Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Trump First 100 Days teleconference. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you'd like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I will now turn the call over to Bradley Campbell to begin.
Thank you very much, and welcome to all of you this morning to our first 100 days teleconference. I want to thank all of the supporters who I see are on the line. Thank you for your support for CLF, and also welcome newcomers to CLF who we hope to bring into the fold as we face what is probably the most challenging federal administration in history in terms of environmental protection. For those of you who have been following the news, I'm sure you're aware that we have perhaps the most environmental unfriendly cabinet picks in history, beginning with Rex Tillerson, who's the Secretary of State designate, CEO of ExxonMobil, Scott Pruitt, who has spent most of his career fighting EPA regs while failing as Oklahoma Attorney General to enforce environmental laws. And, of course, Rick Perry at the Department of Energy, who has essentially said that the Department of Energy should be abolished. So a series of nominees who disdain or oppose the mission of the agencies they've been asked to lead. Here at CLF, we've been busy on many fronts. First and foremost, in terms of defending the critical standards and protections we rely on, we have spent a great deal of time preparing members of Congress who are friendly to our mission on what the relevant issues are, what the challenges are that they should present to some of these nominees, but also presenting and identifying for them the human face of environmental issues that can sometimes become very arcane in the debates in Washington. When clean air or clean water regulations or technical requirements are being rolled back, what is the impact on the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the public health that we're committed to protecting? In terms of climate change, where are the communities and what are the impacts for communities that are in harm's way as we begin here in New England to suffer the initial impacts of climate change? We also want to stay on the offense, and that's going to occur at two levels. One is we're going to continue, as we have in every administration, to push EPA with every legal tool we have to continue on the path to cleaner water, to safer drinking water, and to address climate change by reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The second part of that offense is at the regional, state, and local level, where we have a number of initiatives pushing the ball forward on climate change and decarbonizing New England's energy platform that in some sense will not be affected by the Trump administration, at least not directly. And in that effort, we have allies from both parties and across the entire New England region, from Governor Baker here in Massachusetts, who, though initially a climate skeptic, is now developing regulations to reduce economy-wide greenhouse gas emissions in Massachusetts, to a newly elected governor in Vermont, who has actually made one of his first outreach efforts was to invite CLF to sit down with him and explore areas where we can work together. So there are many opportunities in the climate ahead, even as we face some of the strongest headwinds I think we will ever see on protecting human health, the environment, and our climate. I'm joined today by three of our great CLF advocates, Megan Herzog, who is an air and water advocate, Heather Murray, who is a clean water advocate and also one of our lead attorneys on our suit against ExxonMobil for both current pollution and failure to prepare for climate risks. And finally, we have Greg Cunningham, who is the leader of our clean energy and climate program. And Megan, I want to start off the discussion with you and hope to get a sense of who is Scott Pruitt. We know he's the Attorney General of Oklahoma. He's been very visible in battling EPA. What is that history, and what do you think we can expect from him?
Brad, well, naming Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt to lead the EPA is really, in my opinion, putting the fox in charge of the hen house. Scott Pruitt has vowed to repeal all of Obama's environmental regulations. He has sued EPA numerous times, as you mentioned, and in fact, 8 of those lawsuits are still pending, challenging important rules to reduce air pollution, respond to climate change, and protect public health. And he has a really concerning history of siding with the fossil fuel industry over the people that he represents. As Oklahoma Attorney General, he took significant donations from the oil and gas industry, and as earthquakes related to oil and gas drilling were spiking in the state, he dismantled his office's environmental enforcement unit. So this is really concerning and should be for anyone who cares about clean water and clean air here in New England. That's why yesterday the editorial board of the Bangor Daily News called him too extreme and too hostile to lead the EPA.
Well, one of the interesting questions presented by those 8 lawsuits currently pending against EPA is what happens when it gets to EPA? As we read the professional ethics rules for lawyers and the government ethics rules that are will directly apply to Administrator Designate Pruitt, one would think he would have to recuse from those matters where he was litigating against the agency. And yet if he does recuse, he's essentially walled himself off from some of EPA's most important work. We have a different set of challenges with Secretary of State Designate Rex Tillerson. Heather, what's your sense of his candidacy and what it means for our issues, in particular climate change?
Thanks, Brad. Rex Tillerson is a company man. He spent his entire career at ExxonMobil, a company that not only denied the existence of climate change for decades, but worked to actively conceal what they knew about climate change from the public in order to protect their own bottom line. This is a company that has an extensive track record of subordinating U.S. foreign policy interests to their own corporate interests. So while it does appear that Rex Tillerson has recently shifted his position on the issue of climate change and acknowledged its existence, we remain very skeptical that he will prioritize climate issues as Secretary of State and uphold the commitments made in the Paris Agreement. And those commitments are especially important here in New England because our region has already seen the impacts of climate change, whether it's increasing severe storms, such as Hurricane Irene, which hit the state of Vermont a few years ago and caused devastating widespread flooding, or whether it's the warming of our oceans. The Gulf of Maine is already warmer than 99% of the world's oceans, or whether it's sea level rise. Here in New England, we have miles and miles of coastline, but that means that areas like the Boston Seaport, like Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island, like Exxon's own terminal here in Everett, Massachusetts, are going to be on the front lines as sea levels rise and the risk of storm surge increases. So, I think it's very hard to say that he would be a strong Secretary of State on the issue of climate change. And we certainly haven't seen any evidence. We didn't see any evidence in his confirmation hearing last week where he was pretty evasive on the topic. That he intends to take a strong position on climate change and help the United States to be a leader in the world on this issue.
Heather's had the experience of dealing with ExxonMobil directly in our current case against ExxonMobil for violating the Clean Water Act and creating an imminent and substantial hazard under the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. That lawsuit is based on the company's indifference and disregard, both for the requirements of the Clean Water Act, but also for the health and safety of the communities immediately surrounding the facility in Chelsea and Everett that are at risk because of those violations. And so far, two oil and gas enthusiasts in critical positions. Greg, you've had a lot of success for CLF in battling back and defeating the proposals for unnecessary new gas infrastructure, natural gas infrastructure, and especially the effort to stop the proposals to have electric ratepayers subsidize and bear the risk of those pipelines. How do you see these this cabal of oil and gas enthusiasts affecting those battles?
Thank you, Brad. We unfortunately see some optimism injected into the oil and gas industry here in New England in light of President-elect Trump's rhetoric around opening up new drilling locations and markets for oil and gas, which we've been successfully driving out of New England over the last several years. We have pushed back on natural gas pipeline proposals. Unfortunately, we do expect that the companies will be coming back to particularly the states of Massachusetts and New Hampshire with legislative proposals, trying to get those legislatures to bless their proposal to have electric consumers pay for their pipeline. And if they fail there, they will probably go to our regulatory agencies, the utility commissions, and seek approvals there. We have already successfully won very similar fights in both of those venues, so we continue to be optimistic that our successes will continue, but the fight will go on.
And I think it's important for those who are listening today who are so often our allies and supporters in this of the importance of staying engaged, mobilizing your friends and others to get involved and to sign up for action alerts, and of course to support CLF. This is a moment when many friends have come to me and said, well, what can I do to help in this effort? And apart from pitching a CLF membership, I think the need for legislators to hear from you that these issues are important, and understand that for members of Congress right now, they're facing battles across a range of issues, and we need for them to understand that environment and climate are issues that are important to their constituents and issues on which they need to draw the line. Now, in the transition period, Megan, there's a lot of bluster about, wiping out the Obama environmental legacy with the stroke of a pen. What are the nuts and bolts? Let's take the Clean Power Plan, which you've litigated over extensively. What are the nuts and bolts of how and whether they could sweep rules like that away as quickly as they're boasting?
Yeah. So for our listeners who may not be aware, the Clean Power Plan is the first ever national standards for carbon pollution from power plants. It's a really important regulation, and it is at risk. President-elect Trump has vowed to, on day one, tell his EPA to stop working on this rule. He could ask, there's currently pending litigation over the rule, as you mentioned, he could ask the court to send the rule back to the government so his agency could rewrite it before they have a chance to decide. And even if the rule stays in the courts, a Supreme Court with a ninth justice appointed by President Trump could have the votes to overturn the rule. But I think what's important to remember here is that a new administration cannot simply rip up a rule that it doesn't like. Rescinding a rule requires going through a public process, which can be long and complicated and can include legal challenges. We will participate in that process. And it's also important to remember that the Clean Air Act, as the Supreme Court has declared, requires the EPA to regulate climate change under the Clean Air Act with a regulation like the Clean Power Plan. The Obama administration compiled a lot of evidence supporting its rule and justifying the government's decision to regulate carbon pollution under the Clean Air Act, and it would be very difficult for Trump's EPA to simply change course on that. A new rulemaking would have to be justified in the courts as rational, and we would be there with our environmental allies and with climate leader states like Massachusetts to make sure that any replacement rule fulfills the agency's obligations under law.
So even if they pull back the Clean Power Plan as it is now, they would essentially have to come up with something to replace it. Sounds a little bit like the Obamacare debate. But the work that you've done, essentially supporting the Clean Power Plan in federal court, will now, against industry challenges, potentially we'll have to use that same expertise to defend against challenges and threats from the agency itself. Greg, one of the battles in northern New England that you've been engaged in is this effort to scar the landscape of New Hampshire with a new transmission line that is unnecessary and expensive to consumers. How does the presidential role affect Northern Pass? Will the administration essentially have a chance to weigh in on that and influence the outcome?
So Northern Pass is a massive electric transmission line that's proposed to run through the White Mountain National Forest in New Hampshire. It has been met with significant opposition within the state. It's currently in a state proceeding in which all kinds of analyses are being undertaken as to the impacts of the project, but it's struggling. It's been delayed significantly, and there's a lot of questioning of its legitimacy and need. Unfortunately, the Trump administration will have an opportunity to weigh in here. Any time a project crosses international boundaries, as this will, crossing from New Hampshire into Canada, a presidential permit is required, and that involves the Department of Energy and the executive branch weighing in on the merits of the project. We're very concerned that a project that really is struggling at the state level may get a boost from President Trump, and we're going to be positioning ourselves on the federal level to fight in that venue as well.
The one of the unhappy facts of our work at CLF is that even in friendly administrations, we've seen a progressive, even in the Obama administration, we've seen a progressive reduction in the resources that are devoted to environmental enforcement, basically making sure there's compliance with the bread and butter requirements of the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and so forth. You know, when I began my career some 25 years ago, my first case involved ExxonMobil dispatching a drunk ship captain to run the Exxon Valdez aground in Prince William Sound. And in terms of both whether EPA's been on the beat and also ExxonMobil's culture of compliance, Heather, what have you seen in your work on the ExxonMobil litigation in Everett that's might give us a sense of the corporate culture and even Rex Tillerson's attitudes toward compliance with the environmental laws?
Yeah, Brad, we brought this case against Exxon for violations at their terminal in Everett, Massachusetts, because the company had a long track record of violations of the Clean Water Act and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act at that facility. Both in terms of their current discharges and the pollution that those discharges contain, but also in terms of their failure to take any action to prepare their facility for the impacts of climate change that we know are coming and that in many cases we are already seeing. So I believe that the model of this lawsuit can be applied in many other situations, whether it's Exxon facilities or other oil and gas facilities or other coastal industrial facilities where companies are routinely violating the law, just completely disregarding their obligations under the law and operating in a way that is profitable for them and that puts the communities around them at risk. So I think that what we've done with this lawsuit in Everett, Massachusetts, will be able to be applied in other enforcement contexts across our region.
So we're likely to see an even bigger gap that CLF has to fill in terms of enforcement that US EPA should be doing, that we'll have to do through citizen suits where we can. And also, you know, the sense of that there's even a cop on the beat, I'm concerned, will lead to a lot more noncompliance. But we also have a lot of work throughout the region now that is really advancing the ball on clean water and greenhouse gas reduction. Greg, you've had some major victories and a lot of work on your plate in terms of decarbonizing New England's energy platform. Could you talk about some of the important work that's ongoing and how that might be affected or not by the advent of the Trump administration?
Sure, Brad. We will see in 2017 the closure of the largest coal plant in New England. We've made significant progress in that regard. We unfortunately see attempting to fill the void created by coal plants, an attempt to proliferate natural gas power plants. We have been in Massachusetts and Rhode Island opposing those proposals, and we are currently appealing two of those to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. While we push back on the dirty energy, we are seeing states, particularly Massachusetts and Connecticut, stepping forward and inviting new clean energy. We expect this year there to be contracts for up to 2,000 megawatts of new wind, hydropower, electric storage, batteries, that is, in the region. That's the equivalent of up to four natural gas power plants. It's very significant, and it's a real driver of clean energy within the region. Finally, in the state of Massachusetts, which has our largest population and, as a result, the biggest consumption of electricity in the region, we have something called the Global Warming Solutions Act. CLF sued to enforce the GWSA, as we call it, and Massachusetts is now acting on that court order to implement a set of regulations that we think will act as not only a model for this region, but nationally. So a great deal going on in New England, Brad, that really sets us up to be leaders and juxtaposing ourselves with what could be a fairly negative federal approach to clean energy.
And one of the exciting impacts that litigation has had is that even though the win is in Massachusetts under Massachusetts law, the combination of those major procurements of renewables and the anticipated regulations ramping down greenhouse gas emissions, one consequence of that is that our regional grid operator, which has historically been agnostic on carbon policy, is now in the midst of a public process in which CLF is very engaged to try to integrate carbon policy into the wholesale electricity markets. And what that means in essence is that in the markets that really drive our electricity use in New England, throughout New England, we have in prospect new policies which could include essentially a type of carbon price that would keep New England on track to continue its progress in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, even as the state of California, who's probably our major rival in progressive climate policy, is falling behind in the effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I want to remind everyone that we're going to turn very soon to questions, and you can press star one if you'd like to get in the queue for questions. And if you're on Facebook Live, you can simply post your questions online. But again, that's star one if you want to get into the queue for questions. In clean water, we have seen a number of victories in Vermont, and especially the plan for Lake Champlain to essentially establish a budget for nitrogen and phosphorus pollution into Lake Champlain. That's an important achievement and critical to stopping the blue-green algae blooms that we're seeing throughout Lake Champlain, but also on other water bodies from the Charles River to the Mystic River to to Aquidneck Island in Rhode Island Mashpog Pond. We're really seeing these new and very dangerous forms of blue-green algae. They produce a neurotoxin that's directly linked to Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases like Lou Gehrig's disease and Parkinson's. How do you see a new administration, what is the impact of that on in some of the areas where we really wanted EPA to do more? What do you see a new administration coming in to do? Heather?
Yes. I think it's likely that with a more industry-friendly administration, we will see weaker enforcement of the Clean Water Act, unfortunately, across the board than we have seen with the current administration. But fortunately, CLF is well-positioned to step in through citizen suits to fill the gap that is left if we do see a weaker EPA. And in particular, our experiences with the Boston Harbor cleanup, with protecting waters in the Gulf of Maine and on Cape Cod and in Lake Champlain, we are prepared to meet that challenge head on in the event that we do see a weaker desire by the agency to hold polluters accountable to the requirements of the Clean Water Act.
The prospect is especially alarming because here in New England we're already feeling the climate impact of a 70% increase in intense rain events where we get 1 or more inches or 2 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. It's overwhelming infrastructure throughout New England, and it has created the problem that, you're fighting at the Everett facility. Scott Pruitt's answer, the answer of the EPA designate, seems to be those are things the states should deal with. What have you seen, Megan, in his record as Oklahoma Attorney General in terms of state leadership in enforcing the environmental laws if, as he says, the federal government shouldn't be taking a lead role?
Well, certainly, Brad, as the Attorney General of Oklahoma, I would not say that he was taking a leadership role in enforcing environmental laws. As I mentioned earlier, he disbanded his environmental enforcement unit. He, in fact, in 2011, sent a letter to the federal government opposing regulations of natural gas drilling that was, it later turned out, written nearly word for word by the oil and gas industry. So it would seem that in Scott Pruitt's mind that the role of states is really to advocate for the fossil fuel industry, which I think is quite dangerous.
Yeah, it's very disturbing to recognize that at the very moment that Scott Pruitt was rolling back essentially the environmental enforcement function in Oklahoma, Oklahoma was seeing a 700- or 800-fold increase in earthquake activity that the University of Oklahoma was directly linking to not to fracking activity but to this underground disposal of fracking waste. And yet there, even though Scott Pruitt issued hundreds of press releases bragging about his lawsuits against EPA to stop environmental protections, we've looked and haven't found a single one touting any effort to protect the public from environmental harms, including one that's so dramatic and so immediate to the Oklahoma public. I want to remind everyone that we have the lines open for questions. If you have a question, please press star 1 to get in the queue. If you're on Facebook Live, you can simply post your question online and we will get right to it. And with that, I want to invite the operator to begin with our questions.
Your first question comes from the line of Sri Peril. Your line is open. Please state your question.
My question has been answered. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Dennis Rajewski.
Yeah, I'm live in Vermont. I teach at Dartmouth College across the river in New Hampshire, so we follow issues in both Vermont and New Hampshire. One of the topics that hasn't been addressed so far that I've heard it is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, REGID. I just wondered what you guys' thoughts are on the current playing field and prospects for the near term for REGID.
Well, Reggie assumes, I think, new importance to the region. For those on the phone who aren't familiar with it, the regional greenhouse gas regional greenhouse gas initiative is a region-wide cap on carbon emissions from power plants. And Greg, do you want to give us a sense of where things stand with Reggie and what we're pushing?
I'd be happy to, Brad. And it's a great question. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative is in the process of assessing where it is today, and there are various proposals to improve upon it. And we're very hopeful that the states involved, which include states outside of New England as well as all of the New England states, will approve those. And that would include drawing down the cap on CO2, which would in turn force power plants to emit less CO2. We do have some concerns, however, that particularly in New Hampshire, Governor Sununu has made some suggestions that New Hampshire may want to reconsider its position on REGI. I think he is currently backing away from those, but what all of the states need to remember is that they will be paying for REGI one way or the other, and that they ought to be bringing in the benefits by remaining members as well, because there are monies collected as part of REGI that go to the energy efficiency and other clean energy programs in each of the states, and there are real benefits that flow from those.
Yeah, and one of the interesting recent developments is that New York Governor Cuomo, who New York being a member of the REGI initiative, has challenged his fellow governors, including Vermont and New Hampshire, to tighten the REGI cap, in other words, reduce allowed emissions by 30% over a period of years. And so one of the important things, if you're in Vermont and straddling that Vermont-New Hampshire border in the Upper Valley, is to make sure that your governors, both of whom are new, understand that you're a strong supporter of reducing greenhouse gases, and have them hear from you that they should be following or answering Governor Cuomo's challenge in terms of tightening the cap on greenhouse gases, so that whatever the Trump administration does, New England will continue to lead the way in greenhouse gas reductions. We have a question from Facebook Live. Megan Rees asks, how can someone who doesn't know a ton about energy get involved on behalf of organizations like CLF in a Trump administration? And that's what's known as a softball question, I think. But I thank you for the question, Megan. You know, one of the first and immediate things you can do is sign up for our action alerts. And even if you don't know a ton about energy, you know, we'll flag issues that are up and coming that where you can take action either by contacting a legislator, getting involved, attending an event, attending a major hearing on an issue, and that's really the first step. You know, obviously, I'm honor-bound to promote becoming a member and supporting us with donations as well. But the first step is really to get on the action alert list so we can keep you up to date and help you navigate what is really a flood of information from sources informed and uninformed as the Trump administration comes in. Operator, could we have the next phone question?
Your next question comes from Brigitte Kingsbury.
Hi, Brad. Can you tell us about the collaboration efforts that CLF will be involved with the other major environmental groups as we head into these first 100 days?
Yeah, we work with a range of other organizations in our advocacy, and I would identify probably three different levels. At the Washington level, there are national groups with whom we work directly. For something like the Clean Power Plan, you know, our focus is New England, but pieces like that set of climate rules are critically important to our work. And so we work with them and share the costs and share the burdens and the work of defending EPA rules when necessary and challenging EPA rules when not. We also have a collaborative effort with other groups like CLF at the regional level. There's the Southern Environmental Law Center, the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and the Western Resource Advocates. Very soon after the election, we had a summit among the heads of those organizations to really craft where we could work across all of our regions on a common agenda and on work that we could replicate in each other's regions, but rely on the work, not reinvent the wheel in every region. And that's, you know, to me a very exciting effort, because one of the things we find is that the national groups, which are really predominantly focused on inside the Beltway work, sometimes don't have the same perspective on the ground issues that we're dealing with every day here, and don't have boots in the ground on the ground here in terms of everything from PUC proceedings to state legislative actions, where we have essentially energy bills or initiatives in every PUC and every state legislature in New England, both favorable and unfavorable. And so I think we provide an important feedback loop to those organizations in terms of what the priorities should be and what the strategy should be. And then at the very local level, in efforts like the ExxonMobil litigation, in efforts like our resilience work in communities in Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, we have local groups like the Green Roots Neighborhood Housing Association, El Comunidad, who are all partners in our Exxon work, and similar local community groups throughout New England, who, because they don't have the resources to hire lawyers, or who, or in some cases, file technical comments, we partner with, we give them the capacity that they would otherwise lack. Do we have another? We have another question from Facebook from Fred Hewitt. Do you have any comment on the Eversource partnership with Dong? Is this in line with the regulations that decouple generation and transmission? That's a very good question. And the Eversource partnership with Dong, for those of you who haven't followed it, is essentially a joint venture for Eversource, which is the major utility in New England, to partner with Dong Energy, which is an offshore wind developer, and they are going to partner for the purpose of developing offshore wind projects under the legislation that Greg described, in which the region is essentially purchasing offshore wind energy in order to get these projects started. You know, we're of two minds about that proposal. One is one aspect of it is that Eversource has not been among the more progressive utilities in terms of moving toward a greener, less carbon-intensive energy platform. But on the other hand, it is a positive development that they would bring their heft essentially to offshore wind development. You know, there's an ongoing concern from our perspective, and decoupling. You raised the issue of decoupling, which is the restructuring of the electric industry, where the generating resources were separated from the central services of delivering electricity, you know, maintaining the poles and wires and the delivery to your home. You know, it's consistent with what we've seen, which is the utilities like the deregulation, like the decoupling, except when they don't, and when they don't, they try to work around it, as was true with the effort to charge electric ratepayers for natural gas pipeline development that Greg described earlier. But Greg, I would invite you to sort of comment further on what that partnership with Dong means for our New England Energy platform.
Thanks, Brad, and it's a great question. Very quickly on part of the concern that I think you're highlighting, which is that when a utility like Eversource enters into this kind of a project, ultimately Eversource, in a request for proposals, that is an opportunity for proposals to be considered by the state and by the state's utilities for entering into a contract, Eversource will be reviewing a proposal from another Eversource entity, you know, an affiliate of this company. And so we've urged in those instances, this has happened in the natural gas context as well, for there to be extreme transparency in the context of the RFP so that we see exactly what the proposal looks like and we see exactly what Eversource's role looks like and that we have a third party reviewing it to limit the ability for any kind of foul play or self-dealing. So it's a very good question. This is a very exciting partnership, with that having been said, because it does bring into the fold one of the utilities that has been particularly shown particular animus toward offshore wind, and in particular in the Cape Wind context. So to the extent that we are creating incentives for our utilities to join the clean energy revolution rather than combat it, those are opportunities we're trying to take, and this is one where we want to both make sure we get the legalities right on the affiliate transaction side of things, ensure there's transparency, but also make sure these offshore wind projects get built.
I want to remind our audience that to get in the queue for questions, you push star one, and I'll ask for our next question from the operator.
Our next question comes from the line of Bart Haig.
Yes. What thought are you giving to giving support to the EPA New England Region 1 staff so that they can move ahead in the environment? I was with the staff back even during the Reagan years, and I was able to do the work, my work on acid rain, because Doug Foy provided essentially background support, and he also was instrumental in getting effective, sympathetic regional administrators.
Well, the that's a great question, and you know, we have had at CLF, we have a great relationship with our EPA regional staff and the regional leadership. Our Massachusetts director, Veronica Eady, and I were just last evening at the send-off for the current regional administrator who will be cleaning his desk on Inauguration Day. But the fact of the matter is that that head of EPA for the region is ultimately going to be selected by the president. And we anticipate that, as with Scott Pruitt, as with Rex Tillerson, as with Rick Perry, we're going to see a very industry-friendly pick. Here in New England, even industry-friendly picks have been relatively moderate over the years, and so we're hoping for the best but preparing for the worst in terms of ways that we can make sure that the staff have the tools they need to do their job, and some of those relationships will mean that where the regional staff are constrained in some way, not bringing in enforcement action, or not able to get good policy across the finish line, we'll be ready to either bring litigation on our own or bring litigation against EPA to get the right result. But that obviously means we're going to have a heavier load in terms of resource demands because here in New England, and particularly our region, EPA has retained the primary permit writing authority for many of the states, including Massachusetts, which produces the most permits. One of the issues that is coming down the line, and Heather, I'd ask you to look at this, which is there's a proposal currently that EPA, the Baker administration here in Massachusetts, has proposed to have the authority of EPA delegated to the state as it is in most states. And we have some concerns about that. And Heather, do you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. Thanks, Brad. Delegation of authority under the Clean Water Act to states such as Massachusetts is an issue that comes up every few years. And while it may seem tempting to give that power to the state of Massachusetts with an incoming Trump administration that we expect may be hostile to a lot of the environmental protections that are currently in place, we need to remain very mindful of the fact that the state has an enormous backlog and the state is already at a severe lack of resources. So if there were any effort to transfer that power from the federal EPA to the states, we would want to first ensure that the states, including Massachusetts, are prepared to take on that burden. Because if they're not, it certainly will impede progress, and it may actually make things worse if the state is in a worse position than the federal agency to implement and enforce our federal environmental statutes.
You know, and that issue affects work throughout New England. Some of you may have followed in Maine, Governor LePage threatening to essentially give the water permitting back to EPA because EPA was very appropriately setting standards that took into account the needs of tribes in Maine. So that's going to be an area we're going to be very vigilant. We have another question from Facebook. Sharon Carrier asks, will President Trump be able to roll back President Obama's recent measures to protect land and oceans? And for those on the line, I'll mention that we've had a couple of great conservation victories here in New England that in which CLF played a central role. Most importantly, the creation of the first national marine monument in New England with President Obama's protection of the canyons and seamounts off the Atlantic coast. We also have a new national park created in Maine, which was locally the subject of a great deal of conflict. And the question, much like the question Megan answered about the Clean Power Plan, is how can Trump undermine or reverse those? And in the case of those specific protections that the president established through the Antiquities Act by creating a national monument, there really is, in our view, no way that the president can reverse that or eliminate the monument designation without legislation. Unfortunately, because we have seen in the Republican House and also the Republican Senate proposals to roll back or weaken the Antiquities Act, which is the authority presidents, including presidents of both parties, have used to create national monuments, we think we're going to be fighting on that front. And in that front, noting Brigitte's question, we are allied with groups across the country to protect the Antiquities Act, to protect the authority the president has under the Antiquities Act to create national monuments, which date back to Teddy Roosevelt's establishment of Yosemite as a national monument and later a national park. The one other area, though, where mischief is expected is that although the president can't eliminate the monuments, in our view, without legislation, there is some precedent for the president changing the boundaries of monument designations without legislation. And for a monument like the Canyons and Seamounts Monument, changing the boundaries could have a devastating effect on the monument, because it could expose the areas that are most important from a resource protection and biodiversity perspective. It could expose those to the most destructive fishing gear and practices. And so we're going to, that's another area where we will be watching very closely to stop any rollback of those protections. We have a question from Nina Baker asking, how hard is it for EPA to roll back TMDLs? And TMDLs, for those of you who know, when EPA designates a water body as impaired, it requires there to be essentially a pollution budget, a budget to reduce whatever the impairment is. In most cases in New England, it's nutrients. But Heather, do you want to give us a sense of how hard it'll be for them to roll back for pollution limitations in TMDLs that EPA has established?
Sure. TMDLs, as with other protections that are in place under the Clean Water Act, are put in place through a public process. And there would need to be such a public process in order to roll back those protections or to eliminate them. But the issue with TMDLs specifically is that they require implementation. So you could have a very strong TMDL in place, as you know we have accomplished in Lake Champlain through the work of EPA and the state of Vermont with the pushing of CLF. But that TMDL remains to be implemented. And unless and until that happens, the protections that a TMDL offers are not realized in real life. So in the case of Lake Champlain, CLF will be working hopefully very closely with the state to implement the TMDL, we would hope that we would see strong leadership from EPA on that issue, but if we don't, CLF will be pushing even harder to make sure that the protections that have been put in place are enforced and implemented.
Yeah, this is another one of those areas where one of the most threatening things that the Trump administration may do is to do nothing, essentially to leave those protections and those plans in place, but do nothing to implement them, do nothing to fund them. We're already in a position where we have impaired waters throughout New England, and not enough has been done. We have lawsuits pending in two states for them to actually enforce the TMDL by controlling pollution from additional sources. And in states like Vermont, where the plan for Lake Champlain was just completed, and where we've had a plague of beach closures and a blossoming of toxic blue-green algae throughout the lake that's interfering with the use and enjoyment of the lake, EPA, we assume, is not going to be there pressing the state to stay on schedule in reducing pollution. And that's one reason why we made it an early priority to meet with the new governor to make sure he's committed on that front. We did get some good news on that recently in terms of a treasurer's report committing or identifying a plan to fund the work that needs to be done. But without CLF and our partners and our Lake Champlain lakekeeper, our Lake Piscataqua baykeeper in New Hampshire, without those folks on the ground and working these issues with communities, we definitely have an enormous risk of backsliding on the fundamentals of clean water and clean air protection. I want to mention that even as we had this call, even as Scott Pruitt is before the senators answering questions in his confirmation hearing, NASA and NOAA just released their State of the Climate report, and 2016 has been established as the warmest year on record, and we have seen each year in the last 10 years being the warmest year on record. And so we're at a point, I think, where even climate skeptics need to begin to respond to the science. And obviously one of the uncertainties in that is that we've had very different messages from the various nominees from the Trump administration. The Interior nominee stating that the evidence of climate change is indisputable. Our Secretary of State nominee, as Heather described, saying that acknowledging the importance of climate change, the importance of staying engaged in the Paris Climate Agreement, but somewhat vague about whether the U.S. would remain committed to that agreement, and even vaguer about what steps we need to take to make sure we stay on track to the agreement that 200 nations have joined, nearly 200 nations have signed, to keep climate impacts to below 1.5 degrees Celsius worldwide, so that we can avoid the very worst and catastrophic impacts that may lie ahead. I want to thank all three of our advocates here, Greg Cunningham, Megan Herzog, and Heather Murray. I want to thank all of you for joining us this morning. We intend to convene more of these as the months unfold and as we navigate the very uncertain terrain of the new Trump administration. And in the meanwhile, we, as I said, ask you to stay in the fold, keep abreast of our action alerts, and help support our work, not just by making donations and gifts on your own, but really bringing a new generation of advocates and citizen activists into our work, so that as these issues come before not just the Trump administration, but each of our states, each of the agencies in our states, all of the proceedings that day in, day out, CLF is fighting the fight, so that we have those allies when we need them to persuade decision makers to keep New England on the right path, even as Washington remains in dysfunction and the Trump administration takes the nation in a frightening and potentially catastrophic direction on climate and public health. So thank you very much, and that concludes our program today.
Thank you for participating in today's teleconference. You may now disconnect your lines and have a wonderful day.